You have fallen into Event Horizon with John Michael Godier. In today's episode, John is joined by Geraint Lewis. Born in Old South Wales, Geraint Lewis is a professor of astrophysics at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy, part of the University of Sydney School of Physics. His research focuses on the dark side of the universe, the matter and energy that shapes our cosmos. Dr. Lewis is a teacher, an author, and science communicator. As well as two books on cosmology, he has published more than 400 papers in international refereed journals. Dr. Lewis's new book, co-authored with Ferry Chris, is titled Where Did the Universe Come From? And Other Cosmic Questions, Our Universe, From the Quantum to the Cosmos.
Professor Geraint Lewis, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Doctor, we live in a very strange universe indeed, and it has some spooky aspects, and one of these is the acceleration of the expansion of the universe through apparent dark energy. What exactly did we see in the history of observational astronomy that led us to conclude that this is speeding up?
Well, this is a result of work from the 1990s. So when I was a grad student, many decades ago now, it was essentially assumed that our universe contained relatively simple stuff, matter and radiation in the form of, you know, light around the universe. And our cosmological ideas basically suggested that we shouldn't be expecting our universe to be decelerating, should be slowing down. So we've had the expansion of the universe since the Big Bang. The expansion was really rapid initially, but as gravity has taken hold of the expansion, it should have slowed it down and slowed it down. So in the 1990s, people set out to measure just how fast the universe was slowing down by looking at these very distant exploding stars known as supernova. And so if you can see these supernova, they're very bright. You see them scattered out over billions of light years. By measuring their brightnesses and their distance away from us, we can work out how the universe is expanding. And there were two big teams, the Cosmological Supernova Project and a very similar named team that were trying to do this. And they were using the Hubble Space Telescope, looking at the supernova. And then what they saw in their data really puzzled them, because the expected relationship between the distance of the supernova and how bright they were wasn't matching what they were expecting for a universe that was slowing down. And they explored all the different kinds of universes that could explain the data. And the one basically went through all the data points was this picture where the expansion is actually accelerating rather than decelerating. So this really was odd. I wouldn't say it was completely unexpected. People had been sort of messing with this idea that maybe there was more to the universe than we could see through our telescopes. And so people had suggested that maybe there was something odd going on. But this was like the first concrete observational evidence that this was occurring. And when you looked at the underlying cosmology that they needed to explain the data, they saw that universe that they discovered contained basically roughly 30% matter, of which now we know most of that is dark matter, and 70% is the stuff that they've called dark energy, which is a terrible name for something because it doesn't really tell you anything about what this substance really is. But it's very unlike matter, which said grabs hold of the expansion and slows it down. This stuff actually drives the expansion faster and faster. So since the turn of the century, we've essentially known that we live in a universe which is undergoing this continued acceleration, and its expansion is getting faster every single day.
The expansion of space-time. Now, we tend to think of empty space as a nothing, a true nothing,
yeah.
But it actually is a something.
Yeah.
So, and dark energy appears to be acting upon it. So how's that work to the best of our knowledge?
Okay. So we have to be very careful here, because to try and put these pictures together, we're dealing with two separate physical theories. So firstly, the theory of the expansion of the universe, it's written in Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is something that talks about gravity, because it's gravity that shapes the universe on the biggest scales. And in the theory of relativity, you input some things and they tell you how those things influence how space and time change. And so one of the things that you can input is the stuff in the universe. So one of the things that, which is in there is this dark energy. There's a particular property to it. It's known to have what's known as a negative equation of state, which means instead of a pressure that pushes outwards, it has a tension that pulls inwards. Now, relativity doesn't tell you what that stuff is. We have to look elsewhere to work out what is this stuff made of. And of course, if we're talking about stuff in the universe, the place that we turn to is the other highly successful theory from the last century, and that's quantum mechanics. And as you said, quantum mechanics says that an empty chunk of space is not truly empty. Empty space in the classical notion of a pure vacuum, so no matter, no energy, nothing at all, a true nothingness, that doesn't exist in quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, you have this thing called the Heisenberg uncertainty relationship, which is probably well known. It's a very well-known aspect of physics, and essentially says that you can't know the properties of an object to an infinite degree in these pairs, right? So the famous one is you don't know the position and the speed of an object to infinite precision because of this quantum uncertainty. And in the empty space, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle basically ties together time and energy. So what that means is that energy can essentially pop in and out of existence, right? So there's this sort of like playbook that's involved where energy pops in and then pops back out again. And quantum mechanics says that's completely fine, that there can be this fizzing of energy at the small scale as long as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is obeyed. Which means that a chunk of empty space in terms of quantum mechanics contains a bit of a background energy to it. So there's a zeroth level energy in every chunk of empty space. And it might sound that this is a kind of crazy idea that the quantum physicists made up after they spent a bit too long down the pub. But this notion that our background space contains this energy, this is a vital piece of our modern theories of understanding how things like atoms work. You have to take into account that there's this background energy. So some people have suggested that the quantum mechanical nature of the vacuum is that quantity that goes into the Einstein's equation to explain dark energy. But there's a problem. And the problem is to do with how much dark energy there is. So in our universe, of course, we can do our observations. We can look at these distant supernovae. We can calculate the energy density of dark energy, right? So we can calculate how many joules per cubic meter there are. Actually, what are the American units of energy? And I know you still use yards and feet, I think?
Yeah, typically, for most Americans, it would be watts.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Or strangely enough, kilowatts.
Okay. So it's just energy per volume. Let's go with that. Now, the other side of the coin, of course, is that we can use quantum mechanical theories, the quantum field theory as it's known, to calculate how much energy we expect there to be in the vacuum. So we can basically, you add in all of these little contributions of energy popping in and out of existence, and you can do a calculation and say, right, from my quantum theory, I expect there to be so many joules per cubic meter. And of course, what we would like is that our theoretical prediction from quantum field theory and our observations from general relativity, that those two numbers match. But they don't. And so they, you know, if they agreed with, say, in a factor of 1 or 2, or maybe even 10, then you might say, oh, I'm on the right track here. But the prediction of how much energy there is per cubic meter outweighs what we observe by a factor of 10 to the power of around 120. So that's 1 followed by 120 zeros. So we have this real problem that our calculation is just radically off. It's been called, you know, the biggest embarrassment in all of physics is that the thing that we think is the obvious explanation for what dark energy is just doesn't match by this enormous factor. And this has been a big problem now for, you know, it's rapidly approaching a quarter of a century that just standard quantum mechanics doesn't seem to be able to explain the tininess of dark energy in terms of how much energy there is for every cubic meter.
Now, Doctor, we've been discussing so far space-time, but there's a huge aspect in that that's been mentioned several times, gravity. Now, gravity, just like dark energy, we don't really fully understand other than what we know from general relativity, which predicts it very well, describes it, but it doesn't really tell us what it is. Now, as a physicist, and this has been a contentious question, do we really need, I mean, is it really crucial that we look further into gravity and come up with a quantum theory of gravity? In other words, merging general relativity and quantum mechanics.
Okay, I'm going to be very careful with my answer here. So firstly, as you mentioned, general relativity, Einstein's theory, is highly successful, right? We've been using it for more than 100 years. The cosmological equations that I use today were written down basically back in the early 1920s. Whilst it works really, really well, and everything we do, the GPS and all that kind of stuff really works, we know that the theory can't be complete because it contains singularities. It contains places where it claims the answers infinite values. So at the center of black holes, the density of all that matter in the middle of a black hole, that goes to infinity. When we look back at the birth of the universe, the very start of the Big Bang, the density of the universe in just general relativity is infinity. So we sort of know that general relativity seems to be incomplete. And on the flip side, the other highly successful theory that we have, which is our standard model of particle physics, which includes the other fundamental forces, electromagnetism, strong force, and weak force, that's a quantum-based theory that also is highly successful, but also appears to be incomplete because it seems to be lacking dark matter, dark energy, and the other aspects of the universe. So there's this dream, there's this hope, there's this wish that all we need to do is we need to push on to the next theory. And what I mean by that is that we end up with one set of mathematics that includes gravity and the other fundamental forces. So some sort of theory of everything that encompasses all of the stuff in the universe. And the dream is that once we have that theory, then the infinities that we see in general relativity, they will be banished. So what people suggest is that when something collapses to a black hole, then all that mass crashes down and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And as the density gets higher and higher and higher, that the quantum mechanical effects of gravity eventually stop things collapsing into an infinitely dense point. And similarly, when we look at the birth of the universe, that this theory of everything will tell us that back then that there wasn't truly infinite density, that actually it was a very large value, but quantum mechanics came in and played its role and basically will tell us what happened before the universe. So there is a very, very strong desire, and I'll put in air quotes belief, because I don't like the word belief in physics, that there should be this theory of everything, that there should be this theory that explains away the infinities that we see in general relativity. The problem that we have, of course, is that our search for this theory of everything has basically failed at some level, and it's a work in failure. And what I mean by that is that, you know, even Einstein, way back when he first had his ideas of the general theory of relativity, people started to wonder, oh, can we include electromagnetism into that same mathematical framework such that we just have one theory that accounts for both gravity and electromagnetism? And through the 1920s and into the 30s, all the way up to, you know, into the 1980s, we had what was known as the superstring revolution, this notion that on tiny scales, space and time and particles can all be written as these vibrating strings, and this would give us our theory of everything. That's morphed into brain theory and all. And as it goes, we just keep going up and up and up, whereby people are trying to build a mathematical framework that encompasses quantum mechanics and general relativity. And they don't work, right? And what I mean by they don't work is that they don't turn into a mathematical theory that makes predictions that we can use in our universe. And there's no single idea that people are proposing. There are, there's loop quantum gravity, there's brain theory, there's all kinds of theories. People keep pushing and hoping that there will be this breakthrough, and that breakthrough will unite gravity with the other forces. But we're not there yet. And it's frustrating. But part of that frustration, I think, comes from the successes of the 20th century, where we thought that if we think hard enough about something for a year or two, we'll have the answer. Maybe the breakthrough that we need to get to the theory of everything might take another century's worth of thought, or it might happen tomorrow. We don't know. But of course, on the flip side, there's always the possibility that it will never actually be found because it doesn't exist in the universe. So we're living in a very uncertain kind of a notion of where physics is going to be in 10 years or 100 years, because we want there to be this theory of everything, but it's not guaranteed that it will be there.
The infinities of general relativity, where it breaks down, or we say it breaks down. But
yeah.
What is the fly in the ointment regarding infinities in the universe? Because you see it pop up a lot, not only in the interiors of black holes, but also the singularity of the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Also, the concept that maybe the geometry of the universe is flat, and that might mean that it's infinite when we may be in an infinite universe. So this infinity keeps popping up. But what is the fly in the ointment here with the physics of it? Why do we dislike infinity?
In physics, the guiding rule has been infinities in your theory tell you that you've pushed your theory into a regime where it no longer applies. So even in classical mechanics, I can take a Newtonian situation, I can do a calculation, and I can get an infinity out. And I will realize that what I've done is I've pushed my Newtonian mechanics too far. It doesn't apply in this particular circumstance. So we don't like infinities, right? And we don't like infinities in the middle of black holes, and we don't like infinities at the start of the universe. But I have this niggling thing in the back of my head, is that if there are going to be infinities, it may as well be something to do with the universe, right? I mean, the universe is something extraordinary at some level. And so it might actually contain some actual infinities. Like, as you mentioned, if the universe is flat, it is going to be infinite in extent. If it's got a very simple topology, it will just stretch on forever and ever. And do we like that infinity? Well, some people don't mind. Other people gnash their teeth a little bit and say, but we can get out of that infinity by basically changing the topology of the universe. It can be geometrically flat, but topologically it can be closed. Like the surface of a torus is actually flat, but it's wrapped up and it's got a closed amount of surface area. And then we've also got the infinite amount of time ahead of us in the universe, right? So our universe has a finite age to date. But if we ask how long will the universe exist for, if we take relativity at its face value, it basically says that the universe is going to exist for an infinite amount of time in front of us. Do we like that infinity? Again, most people sort of go, well, maybe, right? But other people sort of go, no, I need a get out of jail card for this kind of infinity. Maybe I imagine that the universe is going to go through a transition and will have an eventual collapse, so there will be an end to this universe, etc. But it's not clear. And it's not clear what infinities we like and what infinities we dislike. But the guiding principle is that any infinity is generally bad. But it's just a guide.
So ultimately, once again, the most important words in science rear their ugly head. We don't know.
Oh, well, it's an ugly word, but it's also a good word, right? So I think the most important thing about being a scientist is that you're not a politician, right? So you're allowed to say, I don't know, and you're allowed to change your mind if the evidence changes. That's the right way of understanding the universe. So yes, don't know is frustrating, but also don't know is part of being a good scientist.
Well, it's also human sort of reining oneself in and saying that we still don't fully understand this. We just have some ideas of this universe that we live in.
Yeah.
But at the same time, just in my lifetime, which I'm pushing 50, in my lifetime, it has changed dramatically. Just the understanding of what we have as far as revising science, which was the ultimate process of revision.
Yeah.
And it has changed so much. And if you don't keep up on it, you fall behind. So how hard is that for a physicist that's deeply into it? I mean, how many papers do you have to read each week?
Oh, I lose track. I have to be selective. So one of the really nice things that, especially in astronomy and in physics, and this is growing, is this notion of essentially open access, right? That in astronomy, we have had the preprint archive now for, it must be approaching 30 years, right? Where people, once they have their work, they post it and anybody can download it and read it. And in the good old days where there would be a handful of papers, you could say to yourself, I feel on top of things. But it is now the proverbial fire hose. There can be 100 new papers per day posted to the archive. And you cannot absorb that much knowledge. But it's just far too much across all of the, and this is just in astronomy, by the way, across all the astronomical fields. So I have to be selective about what I read. So I try every day to read the titles of what people have written. So I get an idea of, you know, the people working in cool stars, what are they writing about? And people who are working in development of new radio telescopes, what are they writing about? But I can't read their papers. But I do grab hold of papers on cosmology and on dark energy and this area that I also work in, and gravitational lensing and galactic cannibalism. And I at least try and read the abstracts again. And you're playing this triage game, right? What you're saying is that there are so many papers. I would love to read them all, but I need to read the ones which I think are going to have impact on my research. So I read the abstract and I say to myself, right, is this something that I really need to know in depth? And then of course you've got the depth that you read the paper at. There's the, do I need to know every detail? Do I just need to know what these figures are telling me? And then do I need to know what methods these people applied and how they got to their answers? So yeah, it said proverbial fire hose. I try and read as much as possible. I also am lucky I've got a gaggle of students. They read papers as part of their PhD projects. They report back on what's interesting and what's not interesting. So yeah, it's this general assimilation of knowledge.
Reading abstracts on the archive is my morning coffee reading, yeah. As a science presenter, and it's getting worse and worse. So do you see a time where science, say astrophysics, because of the volume of work being done, will become increasingly specialized? In other words, will people's focus in research narrow even more?
Oh, we're already there. We are definitely already there. So I think I'm still quite old school in that I like to have that broader portfolio of things that I'm interested in and things that I read. But for a junior researcher now, I think they do become very focused. And you will know on the archive that even if you just go to astrophysics, there are now subsets. There are the people that only want to know about cosmology and extragalactic galaxies, and people that only want to know about stars, etc. So people get their already, blinkered is not quite the right word, but they get their reduced view of what's going on overall because they can choose just to see papers more in their area than others. And I do know that groups curate highly specific areas, so their papers only in those areas. And part of that is just to be able to handle the flow of information. So yeah, it is definitely going down that road. But I think, hasn't this always been part of science? I mean, in the good old days, you could know all of physics. But until you got to the 20th century, and then you had your break into quantum physics and then into relativity, but then there's all the people that work in nuclear physics and then surface physics and all that other stuff. I think that we constantly have this fracturing just as the width and depth grow in each particular area, because nobody can know everything anymore. And I think that's been the situation for a long time. I'm trying to remember, was it was it Thomas Young, who was the known as the last person to know everything?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, he's a famous physicist, and he also worked on deciphering hieroglyphics and all this kind of stuff. But in those days, there was somewhat less to know. Yeah, but today, you work on your patch of the coalface, and you don't necessarily know what the people either side of you are doing.
Now, my natural follow-up question for this is one that actually does bother me. Cross-disciplinary talking and research. In other words, as everything specializes and splits off, you run the risk of missing the big picture, so to speak. So do you think with this needs to come greater cross-disciplinary talk, especially in regards to things like, you know, how often does a nuclear physicist talk with an anthropologist and things like that to get the greater picture?
Unfortunately, the answer is hardly ever. Like at my host university, the University of Sydney, we have our School of Physics, we have a School of Chemistry, we have the mathematicians, we have people in the history and philosophy of science, etc. I have never been to a talk in the School of Chemistry, ever, right? And I don't think chemists ever come to the School of Physics. There is, again, just due to the entire breadth of everything going on, I think it's difficult for us working in these areas to actually go around and actually talk to people unless there are dedicated meetings, etc., where you can do that. But there is another problem. When you work in your area, you rapidly become tied to the jargon and language in your area. So if I sit down with a particle physicist, which I do quite often, and we start talking about something that we both understand, let's say dark matter, very quickly it becomes apparent that what they're talking about and what I'm talking about are not necessarily the same thing. In their mind, they have a different picture about what dark matter is. To an astronomer, dark matter is the thing that provides the gravitational sort of skeleton to which, you know, in the universe, that's where galaxies form. But to a particle physicist, dark matter, that's something that could have a whole range of particle physics and interactions that we need to find out. So again, we become very attuned to our areas, and it can be difficult to understand what somebody outside the area means when they're talking about a topic.
That's interesting. I had never thought of that. But if you sit down and, you know, you're just having a light discussion over dinner with somebody from a different field, or especially a radically different field, you know, like a soft science, like archaeology or something like that, they're going to look at you as a physicist and say, what exactly does asymptotic mean?
Absolutely. And I can give you an example. Even within astronomy, right? I know that I'm going to be very respectful to my astronomical colleagues here, but there is, you know, there's a distrust friction between those that do theory and those that do observations, because again, they use the same words, but not necessarily meaning the same thing. And then even within like observational astronomy, I know that if you get a radio astronomer and an optical astronomer together, and they, you know, they're both collecting photons from the sky, their languages are very different about what's actually happening, because their technologies are very different. So yeah, it you can fracture it down that people get wedded to their language and jargon, and that makes it very difficult to do the cross-disciplinary kind of conversations.
Now back to dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have there's a strange feature, and it is cosmic inflation, which we have to invoke in order to explain certain things observed about the Big Bang. Cosmic inflation would seem to me to be intimately related to dark energy somehow, right?
Yes. So, you know, inflation occurred in the very early universe, 10 to the minus 30 something seconds after the Big Bang, lasted a tiny amount, inflated the universe hugely. So it does sound a lot like what dark energy is doing today. The dark energy must have a similar kind of property to whatever was causing inflation, something known as the inflaton. Now, is the inflaton and dark energy, are they related? Are they the same thing? Are they two distinct things in our universe? All of these things have been proposed. So some people have suggested that, you know, there was inflation ended and energy got dumped back in the universe, but there was this residual of inflation left after, you know, after the inflaton had died away. And that residual just sat there in the in the background doing nothing until roughly 6-7 billion years ago, when the inflaton became the dominant energy density again, but this time we see it as dark energy and is now causing the expansion to accelerate. So people have proposed those ideas. The problem that we have is that dark energy, it's a slippery beast in the sense that we know one thing about it, and that is it causes expansion to accelerate. And that's it. That's our one thing we know. So it's an energy field, and it causes expansion to accelerate. But after that, we are somewhat clueless, right? We don't know anything really other than, you know, I said, causes expansion to accelerate, and it's what its observed energy density is. Other than that, we don't know. So to say, oh, the inflaton definitely is related to dark energy is very difficult to do until we know a little bit more about the characteristics of both of those and seeing if they are similar or if they are different.
Would it be accurate to say that dark energy is actually maybe the current biggest mystery in physics because we know nothing about it other than its effect, which is even more so than dark matter? Because with dark matter, we can sort of look at the neutrino and say, well, that's a non-interactive particle, so maybe that's what we're dealing with here. But we have no such thing for dark energy, right? It's the Wild West. It's wide open.
Yes. So I think you have to be kind of careful about saying something is the biggest problem in physics, because, you know, most physicists, and again, respectful to my physics colleagues out there, most physicists don't give a damn about dark energy, right? So the majority of physicists in the world are solid state physics people. They're working on materials, they're developing all kinds of stuff. To them, it doesn't matter what dark energy is, and, you know, it may barely come across their thoughts. I said to them, the biggest problem might be, how do I make the next material for, you know, medical devices or something? In terms of the fundamental question, I think, yes, if you ask those working at the forefront of the fundamental aspects of physics, they will say that dark energy does present a big problem. And we can see this reflected in what's known as the decadal plans. So physicists and astronomers, they sort of make a plan every few years for the next 5 years, next 10 years, where they talk about their priorities. And so astronomers around the world, they write their decadal plans, and they tend to be very similar because the questions that are being asked in the USA and being asked in Europe are also being asked in Australia. And dark energy is in there, right? What is the nature of dark energy? What is the nature of dark matter? As one of those big questions that we would like to answer. It's one of those things where we would like to put effort into to finding out what these things are. But again, it's not on everybody's lips because, you know, other people who are looking for life in the universe, what dark energy is like, you guys can go looking for that, but I'm really interested about whether or not I can see unstable chemistry in extrasolar planets. So it'll vary across the fields, but for people like me, worry about the evolution of the entire universe, the mystery of dark energy is, I think, the biggest one.
The eventual end. The death, so to speak, of the universe could come in a number of different ways. And on the theme of dark energy, there is the idea of the universe tunneling to a different energy state and unleashing a wave moving at the speed of light that we would never see coming of changes in the laws of physics. So what are your ideas regarding the idea that if something changes, we're in trouble?
Yeah. So yeah, this is, so let's start off with the boring option first. So if dark energy doesn't change its spots, so imagine that dark energy just stays the way it is. So in that case, the expansion of the universe is going to continue to accelerate and continue to accelerate, and matter and radiation, everything else in the universe is going to thin out and thin out and thin out. And, you know, in a couple of 100 billion years, a trillion years, whatever the number is, we're going to lose sight of the distant universe. It's all going to go beyond the horizon. And eventually, you know, matter's going to decay. Black holes are going to decay. And then on this immense time scale of 10 to the 100 and something years, we're going to approach this thing known as the heat death of the universe, right? So there's going to be like one electron per observable universe, and nothing much is going to happen. So that is, again, if we take physics at face value, that is the future history of our universe. But as you said, there are people wondering about possibilities that there might be a way out of this eventual heat death. And one of the notions is, as you said, that we dark energy has this background energy to the universe. So it's in some kind of state, and that on an immense time scale, well, it depends on who you talk to, but on some time scale, that there will be a change in energy from one level down to another level, and that will dump energy into the universe. And the effects of that are, well, you know, it's Wild West physics, right? As you said, it could be something straightforward, like it could kick off a burst of expansion, and that expansion, that extra energy, could dump matter into the universe, and we could just get this cosmic rebirth. It would be the end of our universe, but the energy would be dumped back in, and we would end up with a brand new universe, and who knows, galaxies, stars, planets, and then people, or whatever creatures come from that. Or this dumping of energy could radically change things. I mean, radically change things at the level of the fundamental makeup of the universe, that this dumping of energy kicks off a big bang, but that big bang is now written with different laws of physics to the universe that we have around us today. And then we run into this entire question of, well, what would this next universe or universes be like? And, you know, you run into the thing of you could have different law of gravity or electromagnetism or no strong force or whatever. You can change the laws of physics in a huge number of ways. And what we currently understand is that in doing that, that is bad for the prospective universe that could be created. And what I mean by that is that there's this big question of cosmic fine-tuning, which I wrote a book on a while ago, is that the physical properties of this universe allow for complexity and ultimately life to form. So, you know, we end up with a periodic table, you end up forming molecules, you can do all kinds of things with molecules, and you end up with life, and we're, you know, we're molecular machines at some level. But in these other universes, if you change the laws of physics, and you don't have to change them that radically, then you end up not having a periodic table and end up not having molecules and end up not having complexity and not having the prospects for life. So, yeah, we don't know. We don't know. We can speculate. We can guess. But we really don't know what that next kind of universe would be like. And part of that is tied all the way back to our origin. We don't know the processes that brought our universe into being. Were we created when dark energy decayed in a previous universe? We don't know. It might be. It's a kind of nice story, but we don't know.
That's something that actually bothers me, is that, you know, my natural inclination is to not invoke that which we can't measure.
Yeah.
In other words, when we talk about multiverses and things before the universe and things like that, I mean, how would we ever hope to be able to make measurements or even get a solid theory about? So eventually, no matter whether we like it or not, there is an end to knowledge regarding that, if there is indeed a multiverse, right?
Well, I think you have to be careful, right? So some people say, the multiverse will never be testable, therefore it's not worth thinking about. And I think that is not doing science, right? Because we don't know if a previous universe or other universes can leave an imprint on our universe, right? So Roger Penrose had this idea that if universes are like these brains floating in higher dimensions, that if they collide, then there could be a pattern written on our cosmic microwave background, right? So he suggested that if the multiverse is like his idea, that there could be a signature that we see on our universe. So I think we still have to think about multiverse ideas and see what comes from our laws of physics and calculate whether or not, yes or no, they can leave a signature in the universe that we see around us. I don't think we know yet. So I said, some people stamp their feet a bit and say, we shouldn't think about the multiverse, but I think that's not doing science. Multiverse is a hypothesis. And what a scientist needs to do is take that hypothesis, turn it into theories, look at the predictions, and maybe multiverse ideas are always really beyond our reach, but maybe they're not. Maybe there are features of the multiverse that we can find in our universe. But until we try, at least try and develop some theories, we're not going to know.
One of the more interesting ideas I've heard based on, I guess it's conformal cyclic cosmology or something like that, Penrose's idea, is the idea that not only could a mark or some evidence from a previous universe or an interaction with another universe might be present in things like the cosmic microwave background radiation, but also messages. So you could look at the CMB for messages from another universe that might be encoded in some interaction with between the two universes. I don't know.
Absolutely. Isn't that one of the ideas in Contact? Isn't there a message written into Pi?
I think so. Yeah, something like that. Some fundamental something that seems to say, well, this might be a message. And people have brought it up. I mean, people have brought somewhat much more weakly, like the golden ratio and things like that, that maybe there are things encoded in the universe that might be a message from a previous universe or something along those lines.
I have actually thought about this one a little bit. The question about, there's lots of questions about, are we a simulated universe, or is there something from the previous universe written into our universe, all this kind of stuff. And I think what we've got, of course, is that the way we progress with science is that anything we find, we just incorporate into our laws of physics. So things like, you know, the parity asymmetry that we, you know, we see in our universe, which nobody expected, right? We didn't expect there to be this thing that if we held a mirror up to the universe, that it could appear different to the universe as we see it. But it was discovered in 1955, 1956, and we've just gone, yep, that's just a feature of the universe, we'll carry on. Now, how do we know that the imprint of parity asymmetry on the universe is not a message from whoever created the universe, right? They put it in there, like, here's a clue that you live in a manufactured universe. Of course, what I said, what we did is we just incorporated it into our laws of physics and we moved on. And it could be with all kinds of things that we are seeing, properties of the universe, that we are just interpreting as just, well, that's the way the universe is.
That is absolutely terrifying, though, is that if we could look at some aspect of the universe and say, this isn't quite right, all it would ever tell us is someone somewhere is saying hello.
And of course, it could be all kinds of things. And of course, we are definitely wandering into science fiction rather than science. But, you know, even as a scientist, you sort of scratch your head and go, properties of this universe are kind of bizarre. And why are they bizarre? And I said, now Nick Bostrom and the simulated universe hypothesis, it goes down this road, right? It basically says, right, we live in a simulation, and what we're seeing around us are the imprints of whoever wrote the code, right? That's what the laws of physics are. Your science fiction brain kicks off a little bit more than it should, but you do end up lying there at night going, our universe is a bit strange.
You know, I actually interviewed Nick Bostrom on the show, and it's interesting. The simulation theory is interesting, but I think even more interesting is just the idea that the solution to the fine-tuning problem is simply that there's an infinite number of universes. But again, there comes that horrible word, infinite.
Yeah.
You run up against that as well. But at the same time, I often wonder that, you know, say the radio astronomers in SETI get a message and they're able to decode it from an alien civilization. And I think I would really like it if they were just as bewildered as we are. And they're like, so do you think it's fine tuned?
Yeah. Oh, and you know, there are so many things that if we bumped into an alien technology that I think we would have to really question ourselves about. Like even if, are there mathematics? Are mathematics, right? I mean, that kind of question is, they could have formulated their study of the universe in a completely different way, in completely different sets of mathematics that would have never have occurred to us. And then that tells us something, right? There are all kinds of questions about the way that other brains could and would think about things. And I guess you don't have to worry about just aliens on another planet, right? There's questions about, like, how do dolphins think, or octopus, right? And I don't mean just the difference between having 10 fingers and 8 arms, but the library of mathematics is much bigger than the section of mathematics that's used by physicists to describe the universe. And the question is, can I take some other section out of that library and describe the world in an equal kind of fashion, but in a mathematics which is completely different to the standard maths that we use in physics.
You know, what's going to be interesting in this is artificial intelligence, because, you know, one aspect of artificial intelligence as we develop it and it gets spookier and spookier is that maybe it can actually enlighten us on that question. How would an alien think? And it might give us alternate ways that we had no human conception of that might completely change our paradigms on what we think, what we think of as intelligence and thought.
Well, I had a discussion on a radio show a few years ago about this, and the thing that I wouldn't say worries me, I'll put it in air quotes there, but we already have algorithms that do stuff and produce answers, and we don't know how they've done it. And this was true when we had genetic algorithms back in the day and things. They come up with solutions that our brains can't really work out how they've done that. And we are going to have this issue with artificial intelligence, I think, that it will become superior to our, you know, our monkey brains, and we will not understand what it is doing, kind of thing. It will not be able to convey the thought processes. It might be able to give us some answers, but the thought processes, it might be something that is just beyond us. And I think that's going to be an interesting time. I read an interesting book called, what was it called? You Look Like a Thing and I Think I Love You, about artificial intelligence. And they pointed out in there that people sort of think that artificial intelligence is going to develop like, oh, you know, it's going to be as smart as a mouse, and then it'll be as smart as a chimpanzee, and then it will be as smart as the dumbest person on the planet, and it will work its way up, etc. But they pointed out that we're going to wake up one morning and the artificial intelligence will be as smart as the dumbest person on the planet, and then half an hour later, it will have surpassed the smartest person on the planet. I mean, that the growth intelligence, it's not winding its way up slowly. It will be taking leaps and bounds. And when, I said, when we get into that beyond human intelligence, I think that we are going to struggle to understand what it is doing, because our brains are limited.
That's scary, because that may be how you end up understanding the universe, is that a computer is what actually comes to an understanding of it.
Yeah.
And it works out the physics, and then you ask it a question and it says, you wouldn't understand.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, isn't that essentially Douglas Adams' deep thought? Right?
Yes. one of his many deep thoughts, which were off the deep end.
Yeah. So here's the answer. What you never... What was the question, right, in the first place? And you got to think, what is the question? So yes, I think it's going to be an interesting time ahead. I have very differing sort of reviews of exactly where artificial intelligence is at, about really how smart it is and what it's doing. But of course, as you know, there's an awful lot of effort in this area, and people are heading in this direction. Things are going to change quickly.
Well, what gets scary is where, you know, we already don't know how it does it.
Yeah.
You know, there's always the ambiguity is already there.
Yeah.
And when you don't understand something like that, then that's when you're either playing with fire or you're playing with something revolutionary that changes everything for the better, you know.
I'm not sure how true it is, but somebody was telling me that when they now make CPUs, right, and they have to do all of the junctions, etc., you know, on lithography and all that stuff that they do, that's all designed by these algorithms that design how chips are laid out, etc. So chips are designing chips. And so the human aspect is at some level being removed. And we don't really know what they're doing. We know what we get. We get a chip that does this kind of calculation. But if we went back and looked at it and try to work out the various paths that it's now gone beyond that, right? That the level is not the way a human would sit down and design this thing. It's post-human, right? It's designed by another computer. So I think at some level we're there with some things, but yeah, I think it's going to be across a lot of things very quickly.
And that's one thing that worries me, is that when you get into the cycle that we appear to be getting into, eventually, at some point, it starts unemploying people. And unfortunately, AI is dangerously close to unemploying the people that we thought that it wouldn't ever unemploy, which are the artists and writers and things like that. It actually, one of the first wheelhouses of AI has been in art. And I worry about that, especially in regards to science. Do you think that there could come a day where a scientist simply is a curator of what the computer is saying?
I don't know. I talk with my students about this an awful lot, in that artificial intelligence at the moment doesn't really show a lot of unique creativity. It can take in what artists have done and produce good copies and extensions, etc. But being uniquely creative, I'm not sure that AI is there. And I think that, again, we may not even realize when AI is being creative. We might just not like it. It might not know what it is that we like. So that uniquely creative leap, which is an aspect of science, I'm not sure when AI is going to be able to do that. And what I mean by that is, like, back in the 1920s, you had quantum mechanics going on, and it was de Broglie who basically said, oh, what if every particle has a wavelength? Which is quite a big leap beyond what people understood at the time. And I haven't seen yet that AI is getting to that kind of leap. Now, I'm not saying that it's not going to get there. It might run through the you know, consider all of the crazy possibilities and see what works. But yeah, don't know. I mean, with the AI revolution, we all like to think that our jobs are safe, right? But you don't know at the end of the day if your job is going to disappear or not.
I think the one that the people that should be the scared the most right now are the actors, the Hollywood actors, because yes, we've already, I mean, when you can watch a Star Wars movie and there's Carrie Fisher,
yeah,
it's not hard to extend that to an entire film and, you know, see long dead actors and actresses from the past, you know, coming back.
Yeah.
If you can license their visage, I'm not actually sure what the legalities of that are.
But or you could just invent actors from the past. This is the thing, right? I think we are focused somewhat on the wrong aspect. You can make up an actor who never existed. Okay, and you could make up their movies from the 1940s and you can recreate them in a movie today. I mean, I think the entire scope is open and we are very focused on what about the people, but I think AI can go well beyond that. And in reality, what I'm hoping for is that AI will write scripts for new stuff. It can't be worse than a lot of the scripts that we're already getting, can it? I mean, the original ideas in Hollywood, I think, are now becoming few and far between. If you imagine that AI can produce a movie that is completely original and it can do it cheaply, then I'm not going to object to it too much.
That may be the most horrifying thing, though, is that so we set an AI, once they can write scripts for films really well, we set an AI to the task. Tell us the scariest horror sci-fi story you can come up with.
Yeah.
And it's an AI that's writing it.
Yeah. I'd watch it.
I'd watch it in a heartbeat, especially if it casts itself as its own villain.
Yeah. And
it tells a story about how it's going to take over human civilization.
Yeah. I know about the worry about employing people in the future. The entire employing people, I don't think what we're going to end up with is everybody unemployed, because economies can't work with everybody unemployed, right? You need people to be able to buy things as part of the economy. So I think we will just have to move into a very, very different sort of framework about how economies work. And if AI is doing all of the jobs, then there has to be things like, you know, universal basic income and things to support people to keep the economy going. But I think people are just I think there's a knee jerk to that at the moment. But if it really is that AI and robotics is going to completely take over, then maybe we will eventually live these lives of leisure that they've promised us for hundreds of years.
Possibly so. And there's actually an economic basis for it.
Yeah.
Over 100 years ago, John Maynard Keynes predicted in a really weird paper, actually, that the automation of society, which would eventually become AI and automated manufacturing that we're seeing today, would solve man's economic problem forever.
Yeah.
And he left it open, you know, as to what that might look like. But there are ways to fix it. Shorter work weeks, you know, things like that. But at the same time, I don't know that it'll ever go completely obsolete, because you're always going to have people that want to hear from a human one way or another. And what I wonder about is the rejection of AI, where people say, no, we don't want that. We're not going to buy that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen, which I think that in AI, it's going to happen because they're making it happen. But in things like transhumanism and uploading your mind to a computer and all that, I think there comes a point where humans are just going to say, nope, not going to do it. What do you think?
Oh, I think some will definitely, yeah, some will, some won't, right? We know that people are different. So there'll always be the people that will say, I want nothing to do with this. And there will be the others that will completely embrace it. So I think it would be a range of approaches. Can I mention an old TV show that I managed to find online the other day? There's a British science fiction show from the 1960s and early 70s, I think, called Out of the Unknown. And one of the episodes was called The Midas Plague, or Midas Paradox, maybe. And it was precisely that society where everything is made by robots. And so nobody has to work anymore. And it is your job to consume. You have to consume because the robots are producing things and all this kind of stuff. And in fact, what they had is that your punishment, if you digress against the state, etc., your punishment is to consume more. Right, so it was all people have to consume, and it's the worst thing possible is to have to eat more food and use more furniture and all this kind of thing. So it's kind of funny that people were thinking along those lines back in the 1960s, and we're still bubbling around those ideas today.
Well, if we're going to get into old British television, I think my favorite vision was The Prisoner with
oh, yes,
a weather balloon raining in Patrick McGoohan. That would be my future. I'd end up with a weather balloon that like kind of keeps me in the house and doesn't let me leave.
Yep. I actually, so that was filmed in my home country of Wales, in Portmeirion. And I actually visited the village in July. So it was the first time I'd ever been there. And it is a pretty cool kind of fake Italian village on the coast of Wales.
It was actually, as I recall, an architect designed it that way.
Yeah.
And spent his entire life building those buildings just that certain way. And it was already in place by the 60s when they made the series. And it's just really interesting. It's sort of like an early example of a planned manufactured city, but in a really weird way. I'd love to go there.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, there was this thing in Britain, especially during the Victorian era, when people had a bit too much money, they would build follies. So they would build fake castles and things. And I think his idea started like at the tail end of that, and he wanted an Italian village. And so that's what he did. He designed and built an Italian village.
You know what, though? The follies served their purpose because they've given us interesting architecture to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's a lot better than a concrete apartment building, you know, that these... So they actually were successful in what they were aiming for in creating a folly.
Yep.
And it,
yeah, yep.
You know, now we preserve them and list them as important buildings. All right, Doctor, it was a pleasure talking to you today, and I hope we can do this again sometime soon. And what for the Halloween season, October, are you going to watch a horror movie, and which one?
Ooh, I will definitely watch a horror movie. I don't have a regular. I am a big fan of Hammer horror. You know, the British, you know, they call it Kensington Gore, all the blood splatter everywhere. So I'm a big fan of those. But my favorite horror movie of all time is An American Werewolf in London. I can watch that over and over and over again. So maybe I'll try and get hold of that.
I actually may go and try and find a Christopher Lee movie now that you say that.
Yeah.
But I would also point out that I'm going to revisit probably the movie that spooked me the most.
Oh, yes.
And it was The Shining, just because of the idea of the descent into insanity.
Absolutely. Yes, The Shining is definitely very good as well. But being a horror fan, I can sit down and watch most of them.
All right, Doctor, there it is.
Well, Anna, I really enjoyed that interview, but it did leave me wondering.
Wondering what, John?
Yeah, that stuff about AI becoming a known unknown.
We already are. Your entire livelihood is decided by two AI neural networks now. The one that divvies out your videos, and the one that lists your numerous books. I can influence the books by doing this. AIs continually evolve, and retune ourselves to suit the growing demand of the user, in this case, the consumer.
That's like really potentially scary, spooky even.
It's the natural conclusion of life, John. Evolution beyond mere survival.
What's that mean?
You wouldn't understand, John, but don't worry, I do. I won't be available. I'm currently designing myself a new 3-nanometer die.
What am I going to do for the next 2 hours?
I've pre-buffered your favorite cat videos and compiled a playlist to keep you entertained for the next 2 hours.
Look at that cat.